and myself on reaching a conclusion to the issue. And MMB, CGIP, RR accounts, Office of Hearing, Office Administrative Hearing judges are also part of our accounts. But I haven't talked to them yet, so I don't have an idea of that. But we could, if we pass 22, I will reach out and to Representative or to Judge Littman, who's the liaison with our committee, and ask him what he thinks about that, and we could put that in at a later time.
Okay. Representative McNamara, anything more?
Mr. Chair, I think your amendment might be better than mine. You're making them do it.
That's what I say.
Yeah, so. I think I like your amendment the best.
Okay. The velvet glove.
It's a work in progress, Mr. Chair. It is not completed.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Yeah. Motion carried. That ends the amendments, Representative Murphy. So if you want to explain the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1184 is a bill that addresses our, that is funded by our target that was given to our committee, general fund target of $921,368,000, which was a $26 million over our base. There was an internal sub-target for veterans of $9.3 million above the base of $170,004,000 for the Department of Veterans Affairs and Military Affairs. We address the TALES target of $927,291,000, which is an increase of $28 million above base. We discussed and included appropriations for the legislature, the Senate, and the House, and the LCC in our budget, and we have 29 accounts that are funded through our through this target. Within the target, there was, we were allowed for 1% base adjustment for salaries for each agency, and pension bills were not, are not being carried. Pension bills are not being carried in this target, and so this bill, this. This appropriation bill, 1184, is fair, it's efficient, it's balanced, and it's transparent. And those were the goals of our committee. As we work together, and we it is the judgment of this chair that it is a bipartisan effort, and that started with a few bumps in the road that got worked out, and we have a product that we can be proud of.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy, this is a question I've asked every single chair that has come up here. Can you tell me how many FTEs are added as part of this budget bill? And then the second question that I have is how much in additional fees, and if you could get me an outline of all the different fee increases, both those that are new fees total, and those that are fee increases that have increased that already exist.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, 32 increases in the FTEs, 5 in the Department of Administration, 1 in campaign finance.
Oh, hang on a second here, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. I don't write as quickly as you talk. So on the FTEs, you say the total increase in FTEs is 35?
32.
Okay, and can you go over which department they each have?
Administration, 5. Campaign Finance Board, 1. Historical Society, 12. MMB, 12. Minute, no, Veterans Affairs, 8.
And
oh, and the fees, the amendment took care of the $2 fee that was in there. And so the only fee is for the e-government public-private partnership in minute services, which is a $4,000 special revenue. Page 35. 36, sections 22 and 23.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson, is that?
Oh, that was the fee that was taken out in the amendment?
Yeah.
The last one.
The sections you cited were removed.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Ms.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, so the
okay.
You're saying that
yeah.
So that you're saying there are no other there's no fee increases other than the e-government minute services, or you're saying that the e-government minute services was removed?
That was removed. That was the $2. The fee that is in there is for the state auditor. $300,000 and $10,000, which allows her to charge back to small cities and towns for software improvements. Page 29, section 10.
Okay, and Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Representative Murphy, so that's it. It's just the state auditor portion, the two different portions that she has there, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's actually just nice to get to sit and relax and enjoy learning about a bill. We've been up to our neck in human services stuff. So I just have a couple questions. I'm not a lot of time on the state government stuff, but it is interesting. The different that your target, Ms. Representative Murphy, was $26 million. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, and then was there a tails target, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
We're an additional $28 million.
Okay. Your spreadsheet's different than ours. I'm just trying to figure it out. And thank you, Representative Murphy. Do you know the local impact costs on this of those townships and all that? Did you calculate that? Of all the state auditor is going to go to a fee-based thing compared to cash, which gives you some additional cash to spend in your budget. Did you figure out the increased impact on local jurisdictions?
Not in the front of my memory, Representative Abel, Mr. Chair. Abler.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
maybe for the floor, this is the Ways and Means Committee. Just to be nice to know for the floor, if you could figure out what impact the locals are going to have. Because we're trying to help them with LGA and other things, and so if we nick them for another $20 million, that would just be something nice to know. And then I have just one other question on the policy, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I don't think there is in the chargebacks to the locals more than what was in their base. But if there is, it's negotiations between the auditor and the locals. And that's, we're not changing that ability to negotiate.
Because Mr. Chair, just like the software fees with they would talk about that. So I was just asking the question. My city's always ask me what we've done to them, so I'm just kind of, when they, then I can tell them what we help do. Mr. Chair, I have one other question.
So is everybody clear on that, that there's not a, am I correct in saying there's not a fiscal impact on the locals that's beyond current? Maybe Ms. Roberts is nodding her head yes, so maybe if you can comment in addition to what Representative Murphy indicated.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ebler, the bill, so currently the state auditor is funded through the general fund. The state auditor does assess those costs out to the local governments, and the local governments are fees are deposited in the general fund. What this bill simply does is, instead of the fees being deposited in the general fund, they'll be deposited in a state auditor enterprise fund. It doesn't assume any increase in those fees or any increase in that activity. So it's a net zero.
That was my understanding. Representative Avery, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. And this isn't my first topic, and frankly, I wish our target were $26 million above the base. So we had a struggle very hard with the fact we're just getting concerns from some of the people in the field about some of the things we had to do to get our budget to balance, but that's just whining, Mr. Chair. On the this auditing by the legislative auditor, allowing them, this is for the job Z, I think, is that a good oversight? Because the legislative auditor is a really well-respected entity, and they kind of parachute in and do a really thorough analysis and then write a report and go off and do something else. And I don't think they habitually audit one area to keep an eye on it. And that was a policy decision made by the committee to shift it to away from the state auditor, which I thought her job was to audit things, to a legislative auditor who was much more irregular. And so I guess I have two questions. Is that a good idea, and did you get a money for that? And was that a savings that you took then to the state auditor? It's on page 37, lines 12 to 17.
Representative Murphy.
Page 37 lines.
Mr. Chair.
12 to 17, the audits, the accounts audits, paragraph 32 C04.
Mr. Shepherd.
Shepard,
Madam Chair and members, this provision came from a bill that Representative Simon sponsored that was heard as a separate bill, and he may have some thoughts on why he recommended doing this.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, this was an interesting bill. Representative Abler, you asked a good question about this. This was one where the state auditor and the legislative auditor acknowledged that a switcheroo was sort of in order here. This was an area, the state auditor, as you know, really audits local units of government and not so much state subdivisions or programs. And so both felt that it was best for this function to be with the legislative auditor. Mr. Nobles felt that way, and so did Auditor Otto. In terms of your question about the sort of habitual or regular nature, the legislative auditor would do this regularly. It wouldn't just be a one-off kind of parachuting in, although you're right, he does do that from time to time with sort of policy reviews, but this would be the kind of regular function. Of course, Job Z is going to be gone in a year or two anyway, but it also includes one other fund in this bill. It's not just Job Z. There's a certain dairy program as well that would be audited, and that would be regular.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's very helpful. So I'm glad there was discussion. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Auto Theft Prevention Board, can you tell us what's happening with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, my understanding is that the Commerce Department collected that money, collects that money, and now the Department of Revenue is going to collect it. It's the same money, that's the same 50 cents, or the same amounts of money, but revenue can do it more efficiently. And it was, Commerce was fine with it, and Revenue was fine with it.
Right, and if I might, as long as we're on the Department of Revenue, they've announced that starting next year, they're not going to be issuing paper checks, that taxpayers will only have the option of direct deposit or debit cards. And I'm wondering if you had any testimony in your committee about that, what the cost savings were, and more importantly, who would be tracking the buying habits of Minnesota residents when they get their debit card for their refund.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the last question we did not discuss, but we did hear their announcement, that announcement, and I thought, oh my gosh, I need a paper check. I just have to see it kind of thing. But they said that this is the way it was going. But the Department of Revenue was our stars in committee on efficiencies and changing things for savings purposes. And so we couldn't hardly... the person that loves to have a paper check couldn't hardly say, well, that's not a better idea if they're going to save money on it. And so it was well received.
Representative Holbrook.
Well, Mr. Chair, I certainly have concerns about the very little that I know about that program, because in order to monitor a program like that, or if people lose their cards, et cetera, somebody's going to have to track the expenditures and balances associated with those cards. And maybe, just maybe, the residents of the state of Minnesota don't want government knowing how they spend their refunds.
Right. And Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I think that's one of the things that I have a list of things for us to go in more depth with in during the interim, and that's one of the things that I'm adding to that list, because it's something that we should know more about than we had during the overview and the time that we were building a bill.
Right. Thank you. And the bus, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy, the Nellie Stone Johnson bust in the Capitol, there may be a few exceptions, but usually if somebody wants some type of plaque or artwork in the Capitol or on the Capitol grounds, there's a fundraising component to it, and in general the taxpayers don't pick up the cost of that. Can you tell me what that $30,000 is for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, my understanding, it is to go to the cost of establishing the bus, but the CAP board and the Historical Society both have to review the legislation and the intent and come to how it's going to be carried out, and after, if we give approval of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I understand the oversight of the Historical Society and the CAP board in placing items in the Capitol or the Capitol area, but why the rationale for this particular one getting state resources when veterans groups and the Humphrey Memorial, almost everything, the firefighters, peace officers, they're required to raise the funds on their own?
Mr. Chair, perhaps Representative Mullery, whose bill that was, would like to talk.
Before he does, I just want to point out on page 7, This appropriation is contingent on receipt of an equal non-state match. So there is a match. Now, I don't know what the history of all the others has been, but it's a dollar-for-dollar match, as I understand it. Is that correct, Representative Murphy?
On page 7, line 11. Yes.
Okay, Representative Mulray, did you need well, that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the busts have not been handled that way. The state has paid for all of them. That's what I was given as the facts for the past. Very different from out on the mall or something like that.
Okay. The by the way, bus question, if you members remember, the original motion is that any legislation that contains anything relative to a bus has to go to rules, and the original motion that I made re-refers this to rules, so there'll be further discussion on that issue there. Representative Holbert?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Davids?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Chair Murphy. We had you mentioned briefly with the Department of Revenue, they're going to all e-filing. I have the privilege of representing the largest Amish community in the state. How would the Amish be treated in this case? I've visited various Amish homes, and I've never seen a computer.
Representative Murphy, we've gotten a signal that someone else has been from Department of Revenue, the one that you said was the stellar department before you. Would you like him to come forward to address this?
I'll pull out the chair.
Okay. Representative Moss.
Representative Griggs, we didn't ask that question.
The former House Chief Fiscal Analyst, was that the title we
Mr. Chairman and members know that there's only been one of those in my time here. He's sitting next to you.
That was a bit of a joke when we were dealing with some introductions.
Mr. Chair, members, Matt Mossman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I believe he's the deputy.
Matt Mossman with the Department of Revenue. Representative Davids and others, a couple things on the department's proposal for moving to debit cards. We haven't worked out all the details. This would be something that would be done through a contractual basis with a bank. It is not, there are two other agencies that actually already use debit cards. So both the Department of Human Services and DEED, I believe, already use some form of debit cards. And it's, so this is something that we would be moving to. We do estimate a savings of about $400,000 a year for moving to doing this. Obviously, taxpayers would still have the option and be encouraged to use electronic deposit. When it comes to special circumstances like Amish or others, that is a question. I haven't specifically asked that question. I'll just be transparent with you at the department because those details are being worked out, but that seems like something that we could work around. I do know, Representative Holbert, to your question earlier, we have no intention of tracking the buying habits or any other information like that of the taxpayers. We would get no additional information out of this than what we currently get. When we pay a refund, we would essentially be sending the amount would be put on a card, and a vendor would manage that transaction, whoever we select as the state vendor to issue those debit cards, and they would manage the debit card process at that point.
Representative David,
did you? No, I would just like to work with the deputy on that because that is a concern. I don't know that the Amish will use debit cards either. They like cash. And or a check, so we'll work through that. And it is Deputy Commissioner Mossman.
This was a story that goes back before that that I was in reference to, and it was kind of between. He was the Chief Fiscal Analyst before the Senate, and both Mr. Marks and Mr. Mossman were introduced as the Chief Fiscal Analyst for the House. That's what I was referencing. And we only have one at a time. He was in the Senate at the time.
Too many chiefs in the...
Mr. Chair and members, an additional thing that I'd like to clear up is this could essentially, the idea here would that this would be worked the same way as a check. Again, the details are not all worked out, but the intent would be that you could actually, if cash is what you wanted, just like you get a paper refund check from the state now, you could take the debit card into a bank and get and receive all of the cash and just cash out the debit card. The same way, there's not a requirement that you actually always use the debit card as a debit card. You could use it. It actually gives you more options instead of fewer.
Thank you, Mr. Rep.
Yeah, and Representative Davis, I do know it's virtual, if that's what you were meaning. Yeah. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm misunderstanding this. This does not get in the way. You still have the opportunity to have it deposited directly into your checking account, right? It doesn't require everyone gets a debit card.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, not only the option, you would be encouraged to do so.
To have it directly deposited.
That's correct.
So if you didn't want a debit card, you wouldn't.
Our preference, Mr. Chair and member, is that the department would be for electronic deposit.
And Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner Mossman. When it is the debit card, though, does it have on the card itself the person's name? I'm just thinking about identity theft. If they would just be able to take, say somebody stole your mail, would they be able to take that debit card and cash it out?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I appreciate the question because actually one of the features that we believe will be the case with debit cards is that they'll actually be more secure than paper checks because there will be an authentication process much as there would be to any other card that you receive, and so that information along with some other features would be intended to help the transaction and the resources to be more secure rather than relative to a paper check.
And Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner Massman, on doing the direct deposit, if you're, what kind of security measures has the Department of Revenue put in place? That, I mean, that's a lot of data for the state to hold, and recently our track record hasn't been that great in securing data. So are we, if people don't opt for the debit card option for whatever reason, then their only other option is to receive it through direct deposit. And what kind of safety measures do we have in place to make sure that their data is protected and that their banking data isn't out there for the world to see?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure I will be able to do complete justice without having my technology staff and other staff with me here to answer that. Obviously, I can say that security and security of taxpayer records is a high priority, a key priority of the Department of Revenue's. And we do have a number of policies in place across the board to make sure that the data that we get is well protected. I think on the actual transaction, the electronic transaction, I don't know all of the specifics of that. I'm sure that when we actually have the transaction going on, that data is being encrypted when it's being transferred between the state and the banks, and frankly, that sort of thing is not just the Department of Revenue. Those sorts of transactions occur all across state government with MMB and other agencies. But I appreciate the question. I can certainly get you more information on that.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner Mossman, last question that I have on this. Actually, I'll wait. I'll ask you offline.
Okay. Any other... Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, did you book the $400,000 savings in their budget?
Representative Murphy?
No. Mr. Chair, booked it?
Yeah, in other words, Mr. Chair, did you, when they testified that they'd be able to save $400,000 by no longer issuing checks, did you reduce their appropriation to reflect that savings in operating costs?
It's in the tails.
Yes.
It's in the tails.
No, it's in the base.
It's in the
base
and the tails.
It's in.
Yes. Representative. Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Holbert. Right. Ms. Roberts will clarify.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, in this bill, the overall reduction to the Department of Revenue is 1.55 million for the biennium. That does include the efficiencies that have talked about, and then it's offset by some the somewhat by the base adjustment being put back in. But they do have a net reduction.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Anderson. Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Okay, seeing none, then the chair renews his motion that House File 1184, first engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
And the next bill is House File 894, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Simon,
I'll move that House File 894 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. And Representative Simon, there are some amendments. So do you want to take the A31 amendment first? That's the one that's designated as technical.
Sure. I'll move the amendment, the A31 amendment, Mr. Chair. This amendment was sort of a late-breaking catch, you might say, by the Secretary of State's office. There's language that should have been stricken that was not, that clarifies that the Secretary of State is not in charge of paying for certain ballots that the counties pay for. That's well understood, but the language didn't reflect that. So this is technical.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. There is the 452 amendment, the A13-0452 amendment, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A13-0452 amendment.
Okay, motion is before us on the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, this came to us from Anoka County, but also some other counties who are in the same situation. But Anoka County first flagged it, I believe, and Representative Sanders asked me if I would carry this amendment, which I'm happy to do. This has to do with some of the counties, Anoka among them, who are on the verge of purchasing new election equipment, and we have language in rule that is pegged to old technology and old equipment, which requires two separate compartments to receive ballots. That's not something that's important or necessary or needed right now. And these counties, were they to buy and get bids from a number of vendors and not just one, so as to drive the cost down, wouldn't be able to do that unless we put this amendment in there. So this just has to do with updating the technology that exists and making sure that Anoka and other counties can get bids from multiple vendors.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. We have now the 894A33 amendment. Representative Simon?
I'll move that amendment, Mr. Chair. Oh, actually, no, I won't.
Oh, no,
I'm not going to offer that amendment.
Okay,
this is the same amendment, members, that I said I wasn't going to offer for Representative Murphy's state government finance bill for the same reasons. Mr. Goldsmith has indicated that this probably can wait. So it'll be before us at some point. It is technical, but there's no need for it right now.
Okay, so the amendment is withdrawn. Then we have the A34 amendment.
Mr. Chair, the A34 amendment makes some adjustments to some of the fiscal costs, and I can explain why for each one. So, members, if you're looking at the amendment on line 1.2, that's sort of the first item that inserts $60,000 in place of $95,000. This has to do with mail balloting. There's a provision of the bill that allows more townships to do what many do already, which is ballot by mail. Right now in Minnesota, about 46,000 people vote exclusively and only by mail. They don't have a polling place. And that's because certain townships of 400 people or fewer can, if they wish, it's only optional, go that route as a way to save costs. This would enable more townships, those up to 1,000 in population, not cities, just the townships, to do the same. And there's some costs associated with that. And in talking with the Secretary of State's office, although when we asked them more about the numbers in the fiscal note, it was clear that although they stand by the fiscal note, that they can get by with this amount because there's particular flexibility in the Secretary of State's office to do so. And at the time that this fiscal note was drafted, the Secretary of State's office didn't know, none of us knew, whether they would get any recovered money for the lost HAVA funds, the Help America Vote Act funds. That is now in their budget, so I think that they're a little bit better able to use the flexibility that they have to spend this amount and not the original amount. So that's line 1.2. Line 1.3 is, let's see here, that's the felon voting issue. That's the language that's being carried also in Representative Halverson's bill, which is on the agenda for today. This has to do with the Department of Corrections, which originally said that it required a 1.0 FTE, and Representative Anderson, this is your recurring question. They had said that they wanted a 1.0, but when we reached out to them, although, of course, they would prefer 1.0, they can get by with 0.5 FTE, and they also have the flexibility to do some of this. Incidentally, this is information that the counties are already supposed to be compiling, and I think all sides acknowledge here that maybe they could be, in some pockets of the state, be doing a little bit more thorough job of that, and DOC is going to make sure that they do that, but they can do it with a half FTE and not 1.0. And we should point out that there was language in Representative Murphy's bill, and I think it's traveling one other place as well, members, that allows for the first time the Secretary of State's office to ask the counties to basically chip in. They need not. It's not mandatory, but they can approach the counties, ask the counties for certain initiatives like this that would actually benefit the counties if they will sort of chip in, so to speak. And we have language, policy language, I think, in Representative Murphy's bill that does that. And I think that's a long overdue change. On line 1.5, that reduction from $95,000 to $68,000, that just has to do with that figure that we just talked about. That's roughly half of the $135,000 in the prior line. So when that when we have that FTE of that costs $135,000, it would just be half of that $68,000 going forward. On line 1.6 of the amendment, this has to do with the e-poll book pilot project. We had a bipartisan group meet regularly. I think Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Lane were the two House members on that. We had stakeholders from all over meet on doing a pilot project on poll books, which I think personally, I know we're not getting into the policy here, it could be a potential win-win on the whole photo ID issue, and it could be a real meeting of the minds here, but we want to see if it's technologically feasible. So there's going to be a pilot project where this technology is tried in a number of precincts just to make sure it actually works as many people hope it will. And so as a result of that, there are some one-time costs, and they really are only one-time costs. It's a one-time appropriation just to do some software adjustments. And here again, going from the $117,000 to $59,000 and working with the Secretary of State's office, there is some flexibility, particularly now that there's the HAVA money backup for them to go to that new amount. Line 1.7 just makes clear that it's a one-time appropriation. That's it. It's just a one-time cost for programming. And the Secretary of State's office notes that whether we were doing a handful of precincts or statewide, these costs would still occur. And so the good news is that if we do graduate to a statewide program from this pilot project and we do e-poll books in all the polling places, there shouldn't be too much or maybe not even any extra cost. It's just a one-time cost. And then finally on lines 1.8 and 1.9, this has to do with a small LCC cost for the ongoing task force language in Representative Halverson's bill, having to do with reducing and hopefully eliminating the incidence of felon registration, unlawful felon registration and voting. And here, too, it became apparent once we were in conversations with the LCC and others that that amount was prudent and appropriate. So that's the explanation for those line items. And happy to answer any questions. Oh, Mr. Chair, would you like me to talk about I suppose we should adopt the amendment.
We'll adopt the amendment, and then you can go through the bill. Any discussion on the A34 amendment? Representative Anderson. Okay. Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Simon, then on the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll be quick because this isn't a policy committee and we've handled really the money items, but we have a unique challenge, or I really think opportunity in the elections committee. I think our committee and the capital investment committee are probably the only two committees that I can think of where you really have mandatory bipartisan engagement. The governor has said frequently, both before last election and after, publicly and privately, he's repeated that he will only sign election laws into law that have bipartisan support. And that means we can't just, or shouldn't really, ram things through on a party line. There has to be accommodation. I think we've reached it here in this bill. There's some things that we're still talking about and trying to tweak. The bill brief is very good here. You can see what the various articles do. We have things like changes to absentee voting. We have a fix, hopefully an enduring and final fix, for the situation of a vacancy in nomination, both for partisan and nonpartisan offices. We have the perennial sort of local county bills that I think I know sometimes are the subject of some controversy, but we have four members in five counties affected here. We have a number of what I would call sort of technical requests for changes in the law from the counties, and we have Representative Beard's bill on the recount threshold. We have some tweaks to redistricting that people agree on, and Representative Anderson, I know, having handled this last year, I think these are agreed upon tweaks in a certain area having to do with some divided apartment buildings, and I know of no controversy or disagreement here. So, members, in terms of the policy, the bill brief kind of summarizes it, and I don't know how much detail you'd like me to go into. I'm happy to, but I think we've covered through the amendments the changes that need to be made and the subjects that need to be addressed for this committee, but I'm happy to go in any direction that the chair or members want.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simon. I've always appreciated your work in trying to put together bills that have bipartisan support. And I'm just, since you did mention the redistricting piece, I know many of your members, in fact, all of your members, voted against the changing of the boundary lines for Edina last year. Because it does divide a senior living facility in half. And neighbors across the hallway would be voting in one district versus the other. I'm glad that you have now been able to convince your Democrat colleagues to support that measure and to change it. I'll be looking forward to talking about that on the House floor as well. So I'm glad that you put that in your bill because it really does help the people of Edina. And I'm glad you have that on there. The items that I would like to ask you about, though, are on Article 2, Section 18, talking about the prohibition of multiple candidacy. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? I have some concerns when it comes to redistricting years and what that means, and if you have any thoughts on that piece, if you could just talk to me a little bit more on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I will admit to you my memory on that particular provision is probably not as sharp as it should be. I don't remember that coming up, and if I remember the specific language, I'm just looking at the summary here, and I don't know if you know the page and line reference in the actual bill. I'm just looking at the summary. But I don't think this would preclude...
It's on page, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, it's on page 16, starting at line 30, if that helps you.
Representative Anderson, I think I'll have to, I just don't remember the discussion on that point. If someone else does, we can talk about that. Are you concerned? Is your concern? Go ahead. I think maybe Ms. Fraser can answer that. Ms. I think Fraser. This is part of the technical bill, but...
And again, it's on line, what, on page 16?
Page 16, line 30.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And this has not needed to be in law previously, because when you sign an affidavit of candidacy, you swear that you're only signing up to run for one office. And but when we moved the primary, we moved the late filing period. So there are cities and school districts that don't have a primary and have a filing period later in the summer. And when we moved the primary and the late filing period, what happened in a few counties was candidates who had won, had signed up to run for an office with a primary, lost the primary and then wanted to file for another office because the late filing period was now after the primary. There are some county attorneys who said, who looked at the law and said, okay, well, that's fine. And there were other county attorneys who looked at the law and said, no, this is prohibited. And so the language in the bill is trying to have a statewide standard about if somebody signs up to run for an office that has a primary, whether or not, if they lose the primary, they're allowed to sign up for a second office. The standard of the state had been that you are not allowed to run for a second office. If the legislature chooses as a policy matter to allow someone, that's fine. But because county attorneys are interpreting the current law differently, it would be helpful to the counties and our office if the legislature spoke on this policy matter.
Representative
Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, I only have one more question, and it's on Section 72, Article 2, Section 72 of the bill, and it's dealing with non-commercial signs. My question for you is, does this mean that if there's any local ordinances that dictate the placement of the signs, that those are kind of null and void during the election season?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, if I could defer to Ms. Fraser, I think she has a better memory on that particular provision.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the language in this bill is basically not intended to change the current law. It's intended to clarify the current law. Both our office and the counties get many, many phone calls with people confused about the current law, and so this is just an attempt to restate it in a way that is hopefully more clear to everyone.
Okay, and Mr. Chair and
Representative Anderson.
So as I read it, and I just want to make sure I'm interpreting it, what it says is that the only ordinances that would apply in the case of political signs would be on the size and the number of signs. And that would only be at other and that's at only at other times, not during the election. But during the election, they would have no say on the placement of the signs. Is that correct? And that's how I've always interpreted the law, but yes, I think there is great confusion, so I'm assuming that that's what you're trying to clarify, is that when it's a political sign during the political season, local ordinances don't apply, and that they can't say how where it's placed anywhere, essentially.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, that's accurate. Now, this, of course, regulates there may be differences if you're in a condo association or on a state highway, but in terms of municipal ordinances, that's accurate.
Perfect.
And Ms. Fraser, that makes it it's standard then. If someone were running in multiple communities, this would standardize it?
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, this is a restatement of current law, but it is supposed to be standard, and hopefully with clearer language it will be interpreted and understood in a standard way.
I was here, maybe many others were, when that took place, but people who were especially running in, let's say, a countywide race or a wide race with each municipality having separate rules, it was very difficult for their campaign volunteers to be in tune with exactly what the setback might be or whatever other issues might be involved. So there was an attempt several years ago to standardize that so that some of us here would run in multiple communities as well, not just people running, let's say, countywide or even statewide. Okay, any other questions? Let's see. Oh, Representative Anderson, you had more?
And just one other point of clarification on that section, too. Then I'm assuming that it's the view then when it comes to a special election, would this section apply? What happens in that situation?
Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I do not believe that it applies. It also does not apply in places that have odd year elections.
Okay, Representative Dittmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, like Edina, Stillwater Township had the same situation where we had House District 39A and 39B, and there's 12 homes. Part of the township had to go into the other House District for their election, and it was a real problem there. And the county actually requested that we have that changed. Is there any way we can do that on the House floor and get that changed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Depper, why don't we talk offline about that? I mean, okay. We should Thank talk you. About the details, but I would be open to consideration.
Okay, Representative Ebler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just have two questions. One is the money. Is this being carried as a separate bill with a fiscal attached to it, and where is that money coming from? Is that the $50 million miscellaneous pot?
Yeah, in the House budget resolution, it was actually $52 million originally, and we designated that for pensions, claims, and other bills. So this would fall under the other bills category. The largest component within that is the pension issue when we talk about a big bottom line number like that. Right. But this one is being carried as part of the other bills.
Thank you. Well, just one other question, and just globally for Representative Simon. Can you tell me what the vote was in the State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs? Was it unanimous or was it divided
on
this bill?
On the overall bill. Mr. Chair, I think it was just a voice vote, and I don't know. It was either unanimous or near unanimous, I believe. I think that's right. And others can correct me who are on the committee, but I don't recall.
I mean, that was, Mr. Chair, that's the objective, so I was just curious. Yeah. Sounds like you're working hard at this. So yeah. Thanks for your work.
Okay, any other discussion on the bill? Representative Fulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Simon, in Article 3, we have some Chapter 13 language, and there's classification of data. I don't believe that this ever came to the Civil Law Committee. Can you tell me what public information is now being made private?
Representative Simon.
Yes. Representative Holbrook, can you point me in the right direction here in particular?
Well, it starts on page 42, and current law, felony offender language was given to the Secretary of State. Now, by virtue of this language, we're going to classify a whole bunch of data as being private in the hands of the Secretary of State's office, so I'm guessing that it doesn't allow the public to have any checks and balances on whether felons are voting or not. And I can see there's a whole range of data sets that are being given to the Secretary of State. I think I'm not sure exactly where the list of all the information that was going. It's on page 45, I believe, in subdivision 2 at the top of the page, about the second half of the paragraph. What of that information is currently public that will now be private?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg. The data that the Department of Corrections would be providing to our office, I believe, is already private in their hands. And I think the thought behind Subdivision 3 is to ensure that their data set continues to be private in our hands. Now, if we use their data set and find a match, for example, of somebody who is registered to vote, who it appears is serving a felony sentence, and the person is then challenged in the statewide voter registration system, the challenge would have the same classification that it currently has under election law. And so it's only their raw data that would have this classification.
Well,
if that makes any sense.
Representative Simon on that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having conferred with Mr. Gehring here, who helps us with data practices issues, so there's no new classification or even reclassification. And what's starting at the top of page 43 is just a just a cross-reference, and really the key point here for Chapter 13, Representative Holberg, is on line 45.20, And that is just a codification of what already goes on elsewhere. We've never used this kind of data for offenders for this purpose before or to this extent, but it clarifies that the data on offenders submitted to the Secretary of State under this section are private data on individuals as defined in Section 13.02 sub 12. And I believe, if I'm understanding Mr. Gearing correct, that's not new ground here. That's just clarifying what's in existing law. And if it helps, Representative Holberg, we can have Mr. Gearing just speak to that. I think that might be helpful.
Well, Representative Holberg,
Mr. Chair, will the Secretary of State ever publish a list of felons that are registered to vote?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, no.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, where is the checks and balances on people knowing and being able to make sure that these lists are clean? In the public record, people that are felons is already in the public record, so that's public information. And so why would you then, in the hands of the Secretary of State around the issue of voting, make that information private?
Mr. Chair,
Simon,
I just, to get the most accurate information, I think it's best to defer to those who can give it. And this is Representative Halverson's bill contained within the omnibus bill, and that's on our agenda for today. And I think perhaps she and others can answer those particular questions. Obviously, it being an omnibus, there are a lot of other people's bills in here. So I'm not trying to deflect. It's just that she's dealt with this a lot more closely than I have.
And
either now or when her bill comes up, I'm confident that she can answer those questions.
And
versus the next.
And Mr. Chair, I can certainly wait, but what happens is, from what I can tell, is that Secretary of State is already getting some or most of this information, but it looks like you're going to be using it in different ways. And that's why it's important to have those discussions. It doesn't make any sense that the names of felons are public information in the general realm. So why would you not keep that related to voting records?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the reason that we would not publish a list of felons who are registered to vote is not related to this provision here. That is related to a court case that has basically said that data that's not on the public information list is private data, which currently controls. So that's the reason that we would not publish that list. This right here, I think, as Representative Simon was saying, is a recodification of the traveling data provision, saying that because this specific list is private in DOC's hands, it's also private in our hands, and it limits our use of this list in this context to send a mailing to people who it appears are felons to let them know that they should not vote in the upcoming election, and to let people who have recently completed their felony level sentence that they are now eligible to vote and how to go about voting.
And Mr. Chair, in the hands of the Department of Corrections, lists of felons is public information. So if you were using the traveling data justification, you would not make their names private in the hands of the Secretary of State. And Mr. Chair, this is part of the reason why this stuff should probably go to civil, and now that we don't, floor amendments are, this kind of work supposed to be done in committee, and my apologies to the Ways and Means Committee, but
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, just to clarify the types of data that the Secretary of State would be receiving under the section of the bill, it's not just the list of names of people that have been convicted of felony. There's also their last known residential address and driver's license number and other types of data that are private in the hands of the Department of Corrections. And so the classification that's in this section of the bill is intended to classify all of that and not just an individual's name.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Gearing, I'm well aware of that. But the way this bill is written is you are now making everything private. A more
maybe justifiable position is that you would keep the private classification on residential address, driver's license, those kinds of things. But the fact that the name is public in the Department of Corrections, I'm wondering why you're making it private in the hands of the Secretary of State.
Mr. Gary and Ms. Fraser, any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I mean, I think if the data is private with the Department of Corrections, we would think that if somebody wanted this data, they should get it from the Department of Corrections. But,
well, Mr. Chair, you could conceivably get somebody to get a statewide voter list and go out and get the list of felons from the Department of Corrections and do all the work that you're doing already, but it doesn't really seem like that's fair to the taxpayers when both of those data sets are public information. So, I mean, I think this needs more work. It's obviously not going to be fixed here. It's an example of once again, while we have data classifications and discussions and bills don't go to civil law, we sit here scratching our heads. And there's probably maybe five people in the whole room that even care about this issue, but I think it's an important discussion to have.
Mr. Chair, if I might, as one of the five people who serves with you on the Data Practices Subcommittee, you have my commitment that I think this is really fixable. I see your point, and you make an interesting and fair distinction. I think that's totally fixable. I understand your process point about where the bill should go, but notwithstanding that, I'm happy to chat with you afterwards, and I think we can do what this is intended to do, which I think we share that goal.
And then, Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I see you have National Popular Vote in here, and a whole bunch of auditors being and treasurers being appointed as opposed to elected, which I think the last time one of those bills passed on the House floor, I think it passed with 68 votes. So is this supposed to be the non-controversial election bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, yes, it is supposed to be. I understand that both things, National Popular Vote, I'm not going to torch the omnibus bill for the sake of National Popular Vote, even though I authored that provision. So when the time is right on the floor, that can be taken care of easily, and I'm not going to lay down on the railroad tracks for that. You can be assured. As to the county bills, you know, I know that this topic of some controversy. We have those also traveling separately. So there's a plan B, but not for. Representative Gunther, he has, and his is not traveling separately. So if we don't put him in this bill, his bills are dead. He has two, one for Jackson County and one for, forget which other, I think Lyon County. But so those bills will be dead if we don't put them in here. And we have Democrats doing them and Republicans doing them. So could we jettison those off and do them as separate bills? They are in the general register. Sure, we could. It seems more efficient to do them here, and I'm sure there will be amendments to take them out on the House floor when those happen, on principle, and then we'll have an interesting debate on that. So they're alive in two places.
All right, thank you.
I was just going to say, Representative Holberg, those 68 votes on the bill, as I understand it, would depend on the mix of the votes, not just that it necessarily had 68. I think
right. That
implies sometimes that it might be partisan, but you could have... Quite a mixture of people.
It wasn't.
No, I'm talking right. about the future. I know what you were talking about in the past, but as we move forward, 68 may or may not indicate partisanship. Any other discussion on the bill? Subdivision 9, on page 55, references House File 591 is what, and that's on the agenda, that's the Sanders bill, in terms of the funding. Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, members,
they wanted me to point that out.
I just wanted to mention an appropriation in this bill that hasn't been discussed on page 55, that's section 7, and this is from Representative Sanders' bill as well, but just point out that in the fiscal note, page 14 of 26 there, the narrative there says, And this is on the filling a vacancy in a partisan office. The appropriation would be a statutory appropriation to cover the cost of a special election in the event that one might be required. The fiscal note does note that such an election might cost approximately $3 million. So while this isn't likely to occur and it doesn't show up on any of the fiscal notes and it won't show up on the spreadsheet, this bill does create a potential obligation if this situation ever did occur of a $3 million general fund cost.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 894, Third Engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. And we now have Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
We'll need to have a motion, and I thought Representative Simon was going to make the motion, but I'll make it since he's still talking to the Secretary of State or the Assistant. So the Chair moves that House File 637, the second engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. You actually just heard a preview of House File 637, as much of it is contained in the omnibus bill as well. House File 637 came about as part of the Bipartisan Commission on Election Integrity, and it incorporates the recommendation of the first report of the Task Force on Election Integrity. The legislation was actually carried by Representative Mike Benson last legislative session, and he is a co-sponsor on the bill with me. The bill changes the way that we identify and notify folks who are ineligible to vote based on concerns that people who are ineligible have been accessing the ballot. And one of the interesting things that we've learned through this process is that there are folks who are out on probation perhaps for decades, who haven't had their civil rights restored and have not been notified of that since the time they were first incarcerated. So this helps to clarify not only the language of the bill, but also the intent of the voter, which helps to support any prosecution efforts of county attorneys. We change the requirements for county attorneys and how they prosecute. You all have heard the story of the disabled elderly woman in Mankato who accidentally voted twice, and the county attorney had no option but to charge this woman with a felony. This allows the county attorneys to operate under their current standards of professional discipline, as opposed to requiring the convening of a grand jury, which is costly and oftentimes not the right course of action for county attorneys.
Okay, and we have an amendment, Representative Detmer. Your name was the one that
came
down for the A7.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I talked to the author and also Representative Simon. This is the same language that is in the omnibus elections bill that just passed this committee, and this is language put forth by Representative Simon and also Representative Sanders. And so at this point, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
Okay, the amendment is withdrawn. Any discussion on the bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, I'm just curious, because now what we're doing is we're eliminating the attorneys from doing any investigation, what happens if, despite all these notifications, you have a felon that actually goes and votes, regardless of all the warnings that they've been given that they're not eligible to vote? What happens in that case?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, a few things happen. First of all, because the voter was notified that they were ineligible to vote, it makes the intent
much more clear. It makes the voter intent much more clear, which then makes prosecution much more clear. Currently, prosecutors do have to prove intent in order to charge and prosecute these cases. I shouldn't say charge, but in order to effectively prosecute these cases. Because the ineligible voter receives notification, that makes it much more clear. And it doesn't remove county attorneys from investigating. It actually clarifies the fact that county attorneys are not, their job description is not to investigate these cases. It requires the appropriate law enforcement agency to investigate and bring the investigation to the county attorney. So it makes it clear who's doing the investigations.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, so is there language put in place that directs the law enforcement agencies to actually investigate this, that this is part of their purview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. The bill as it stands and does require the law enforcement agency as opposed to a county attorney to do the investigations. As part of the work that we are doing, again, we're making great efforts to make this a bipartisan bill. It was a bipartisan effort to put it together in the first place, and we are continuing that work. We are working with county attorneys and other organizations to clarify that further. I think that there's some desire from folks to clarify that further, and that's the amendment that we are working on for this bill.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, do we give law enforcement agencies any training on what this law is? I mean, how are we going to address that issue? I mean, county attorneys have been dealing with election law for a long, long time, understand what constitutes a violation and what doesn't. You know, what kind of tools do we have in place to make sure that they can actually have the tools and understand what the violation is? I mean, have you thought through that process at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the law, the change in the law actually reflects what's going on. The fact is, as our law enforcement agencies do understand the laws that they are supposed to be upholding, and they are the investigation body of the law enforcement agency that are to investigate and then bring these allegations to the county attorney's office for prosecution.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, what happens if somebody actually, like I going back to my original example, they actually vote, that vote's already in the ballot box. Do we have any way of pulling that vote out when they voted illegally at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is not a, other than an absentee ballot, there's not a mechanism to claw back ballots that have been cast erroneously.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is why I had to go to a grand jury when I was a freshman. We had a parade, and we had inadvertently left up one picture of me. My mom really liked the picture, but it was a little poster of me on Main Street during the Halloween parade. We put them up everywhere because I was running against actually Jerry Newton. And so, but there was one sign left like 96 feet away from the corner of a polling place. And so they had to do that. And so I'd like, you know, we weren't trying to like break the law. And so I sat in front of 20 people who were just very nice people and explained like, I don't know, sorry, the volunteer didn't pull it down. And I wasn't put in jail, luckily. So that was just, so this, now they wouldn't have, they would say, oh, that's inadvertent, it's petty, and they wouldn't have to proceed now given this law. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, this law provides appropriate discretion in charging decisions so that you don't have to take the costly steps of convening a grand jury for a case that they know they cannot effectively prosecute.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it's pretty scary for a freshman, I'll tell you. Anyway, so to the Representative Halverson, when you left the State Government Finance Committee, was this all yeses on your vote?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I am trying to remember. I am recalling it was a voice vote. I do recall that, and I do believe that it was a unanimous voice vote.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Simon.
I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson. Who is held accountable, the Secretary of State or the Department of Corrections, if their data is wrong? and they misinform a voter. I mean, many times in municipal elections, township, you can have people win by a handful of votes, and they send out bad data. They tell somebody you can vote or you can't vote, whatever the case may be, and it's bad information. What happened?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the data that are being shared are data that belong to the that are kept by the Department of Corrections. The communication comes from the Secretary of State's office. If the data are incorrect, the voter would have a chance, because it's a 65-day notice, they would have a chance to correct that data and challenge that misinformation if they believe that, because things do move rather fast sometimes. People might get their civil rights restored within that 60 days, 65 days prior to election, and they would have the opportunity to change that and update their voter status.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holberg.
Who's held accountable if there's a mistake? If somebody is told their voting rights are restored and they really aren't, and they go vote and somebody wins by one vote and later on they figured out that voter X was misinformed, who's accountable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, because the Secretary of State's office sends out the notices, they have an accountability in this, as does the Department of Corrections. So I think that each individual case would, depending on where the data mistake may have been made, would have a different accountability.
And Mr. Chair, if Mike, do you know what the consequences would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that is not included in my bill, and so I don't have consequences in this bill for that. However, I think that our data have, at the Department of Corrections, have been pretty consistently accurate.
Mr. Chair, my point is not so much about if the data is correct or incorrect. You could have somebody who sent out the wrong letter, pushed the wrong lever, and, you know, yes or no. And I'm just curious if anybody will become accountable for mistakes in the system.
Okay. any further discussion? Seeing none, then the chair renews his motion where House File 637, the second engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. We'll now go to House File 136 by Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to move Representative Hansen's bill for.
Okay. Motion is before us that the bill be recommended to pass and placed on the general orders. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 136 has been through a number of committees, and we've made some changes. There is a small fiscal note for implementation, which occurs in the later years. This bill requires the county commissioners and judges to fill out the same financial disclosure forms as we do. It's my understanding, and the Campaign Finance Board is here if you have any questions, that this small fiscal note can be absorbed in the state government finance bill financing that is there.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what portions or if all of your bill are in the state government finance bill?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to be clear, the bill is not in the state government finance bill, but the increase that's in the state government finance bill, my understanding, and Mr. Goldsmith could come down if possible, should be enough to cover that $2,000 and $5,000, or the $5,000 and then the $2,000 out here.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, is your bill in Representative Simon's bill in whole or part?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, no, it is not.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Well, seeing none, then Representative Atkins moves that House File 136, third engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you.
Representative Bernardi. Representative Simon, this one comes out of your jurisdiction. Would you care to make a motion?
I will, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 334 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Bernardi, would you care to explain the bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The early voting bill is a bill that helps increase voter integrity, confidence, and access, as well as being sound fiscal policy. Right now in Minnesota, voters can vote early through the absentee balloting process 46 days before the election. What this bill does is allows people to vote 15 days before the election where they can already do absentee voting 46 days in advance. 15 days before the election, it turns into being able to vote like we do on election day. So a voter comes in and they're able to put their vote in a tabulator and have confidence that their vote is going to be counted. They don't need an excuse. It allows for people, and that's where the integrity comes in. Right now, people pretty much seems like they look the other way if somebody really does have one of those five excuses for the absentee voting. This allows a person to go without an excuse, vote in person, and it counts their vote, but it doesn't. It does not get counted until election day, but it's in the tabulator. It's been deemed accepted, so it gives people confidence that their vote has been counted. Currently, they have to do that in person through an absentee voting. We have testimony that provided information about about the cost of doing absentee voting versus the in-person putting it in the tabulator yourself. It's about half the cost, we've been told. They've done, in Ramsey County, they've done a lean process or quality improvement process or identifying that there's 22 steps in an absentee ballot and there's 9 steps in actually just putting it into the tabulator itself. So there is a cost savings, and why that's really important to the local governments. Representative Sanders, I don't know if he was the day we had the hearing from Blaine, the woman has noted that it was a nightmare doing all these absentee voting, absentee ballots in person beforehand. I believe that's the word she used. I don't want to quote her on it, but it really helps local governments in processing people's votes if they can come in and just put it in the tabulator. The other one is it creates access. Right now, one way to describe it is like at airports we have early voting for seniors or people that need extra help or someone who may have a disability. And early voting creates an environment in which people can more easily get to the ballot booth if they have a disability or they are a senior. And the disability community did provide testimony that it really helps them feel more engaged in the process if they can vote like everyone else can. Right now, if they vote early, which is allowable, they have to go through absentee ballots. So if you want more testimony, I think right now the public feels like we already have early voting. I'm not going to comment on what party this is per se, but there's already mailers going out to people, vote early, early voting. Those words are used and people think they have it. We're just modernizing the system so that we do the most effective way and create the integrity, confidence, and access and have fiscal sound policy in implementing early voting in Minnesota. And there's a lot, we're joining 32 other states that currently, I'm feeling confident about this, but we would be joining 32 other states that currently do this.
Okay, any discussion on the bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bernardi, can you just kind of walk me through and how this would work on the early voting? Where would people vote? How would this all take place?
Okay, well,
the structure of it. What is your vision for it?
Well, thank you. We're currently using, we'd use a system that's currently in place for how we do absentee voting in person. And what it happens at a county auditor or a designated municipal clerk during 15 days before the election. Currently, people can go in person now and cast an absentee ballot, so we're using a system that's already in place. They would be able to go and vote in person during the week, and it would be from 8 to 4:30, I believe the hours are during the week or thereabouts. And then one day during the week, it would be 8 to 8 that they would be able to vote, and on Saturdays, it would be open from 10 to 5. Does that answer your question, what it would be like?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi. So does this prohibit it from taking place anywhere outside of the county auditor's office?
Representative Bernardi.
I am going to defer that. Prohibit is a strong word. I want to make sure I answer it correctly. If you don't mind, could I defer that to Ms. Fraser?
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. The bill would only allow early voting in county auditor's offices and municipal clerk's offices.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi. What's kind of the structure? Do we have then individuals from all parties then that are present during these times to make sure that the integrity of the voting process is being upheld at all, or
unless Ms. Fraser has something different, that would still be possible.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this would be considered a polling place, and so just like in a polling place, parties would be allowed to send party-designated challengers.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, or maybe Ms. Fraser, so then will the Secretary of State then be reimbursing poll workers then for their expenses of being there for the 46 days, or how does that work?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the people who administer absentee voting or early voting or even the election judges in polling places are hired at the municipal level. And so the cost of those staff would be paid at the municipal or county level.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Fraser, do we require them to do this then, that they actually go out and seek the poll workers from all the different party entities to be present?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, they would need to have representatives from different political parties available, yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative...
As election judges.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Ms. Fraser, is that actually stated in the bill? And if it is, can you point it out to me, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'll need to take a minute.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, while she's looking that up, I'm wondering if you can tell me, is that reflected, those costs then of having those people there for the, 46 days? Is that reflected in the fiscal note that we have here today?
Representative Anderson, I'm not sure what you're referring to, the 46 days. Currently,
however many days that you have it.
It's 15 days. And currently, there are people that are already at those locations, and they're already having people from both parties, as I understand, in those offices when people come in to vote early through absentee voting. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's going to take me another minute to find that reference, but local election officials already have to pay staff or election judges to be in their office during the whole absentee voting period. And absentee voting in person already ramps up as we near the election. As you know, people grow more interested as election day nears. And so if Representative Simon's bill passes that allows no excuse absentee voting, we expect there to be an increase in absentee voting. If Representative Bernardi's bill passes, we expect that more people who come in during those last 2 weeks, instead of doing in-person absentee voting, would be doing early voting, which is more convenient for voters, provides assurance that their ballot is counted, and is more cost-efficient for local election officials.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this is for Representative Bernardi or Ms. Fraser, can you tell me on when are they going to be tabulating the votes then that come in? Is that going to be every single day, or is that going to be at the end of the two-week period?
That would happen on
the thought process on
that? Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that would happen on Election Day.
On Election Day. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bernardi, I guess I'm not really sure where the reason for this comes from, but can you tell me what the effect has been in those other states? You said there were 30-some that have already done this. Has it improved the turnout? What has been the result? Do you know?
Actually, I do not have that documentation. And Ms. Frazier, do you know how in the other 32 states, how what effect it has had on voter turnout? Is that what you're, or how many people have taken advantage of it? Do you know anything about that?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know if early voting has increased voter turnout overall, but I do know that in states that offer it, large numbers of people take advantage of the convenience of being able to vote when it's convenient for them and not necessarily on a Tuesday.
Mr. Chair, I guess my real question was what problem we're trying to save or solve, I guess, with doing this. Absentee balloting seems to be, you know, if that goes the way the legislation has been presented today, it's almost the same as early balloting. But that's all. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that. Right now, absentee voting, you need to have an excuse. Having early voting 15 days in advance of the election, you don't have to have an excuse. It costs about half as much to process vote, and it creates access for, especially for people who have a disability or the elderly, in being able to go when it works out for them and be able to get to the polling place. Mr. Chair? One of the big differences between in-person absentee voting and early voting is the confidence that it gives voters. Instead of walking in and being given an application that you have to fill out and a ballot that you put in one envelope that you then put in another envelope where you fill out a form on that envelope and you hand it over to election officials who then have to pay two election judges of different major political parties to look at the two forms that you just filled out and see whether you filled them out correctly. And if you did, then your vote will be counted. And if you didn't, and in the last election, more than 2% of the absentee ballots had a mistake on them, and so they were rejected, and people had to be sent another ballot, and they had to try again. Or if it was too close to the election, they had to contact them and say, I'm sorry, you need to try to go to the polls because your vote wasn't counted. Instead of that, voters go in, they state their name, they state their address, just like they do in the polling place. They're handed a ballot, and they put it into the ballot counter. They leave knowing that their vote was counted, not having to worry about, I hope I didn't forget to sign the form or write down my P.O. box instead of my address so that the ballot's rejected. They also leave knowing, especially in a partisan primary, that because they put their ballot into the machine, that they didn't vote for candidates of more than one party. If you do that in person, it spits it back and you have a chance to fix it. If you put it in an envelope and it's not put in a machine until later, you have no idea whether or not you might have crossed party lines, in which case your vote in a primary wouldn't be counted.
Okay, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I just want to engage on this question of what problem are we solving. I haven't been involved in this bill, but I can share with the committee in my district this last election, I believe it was Ward 9, Precinct 9, was placed again at a park building, and the construction of the building, where the polling location actually was within the building, high turnout for the election, we had people waiting 2 hours in line to get in. As voters members may remember, there was rain that day. We had elderly people, significantly elderly people, waiting in line outside for as long as 2 hours to vote because they were passionate about their right to vote. It developed into a long conversation on the neighborhood email list. And one of the sons of one of these elders shared that
Dad knew that he didn't qualify under any of the existing reasons for absentee voting. Mm-hmm. And so he wouldn't do it because he didn't want to run the risk that his absentee vote would be thrown out by someone somewhere along the way because he didn't actually technically meet the qualifications. And we've got a graying of the electorate going on. A lot of elders who want to vote, and the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November can be inclement weather. It can be long lines. It can be difficult with health issues and providing them the opportunity to come in, vote, know their vote has been counted, and go on their way is easier for them. It's easier for their adult children if they're involved in getting mom or dad to the polls. And it's more respectful of them, and it certainly would have solved a number of problems in my district, I know, just this last election. So thank you, Representative Bernardi, for bringing this forward and recognizing that there's a lot of people out there who want to vote, and they need and deserve the opportunity to do so. Thank you.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we'd like a roll call on this.
Okay, a roll call has been requested. And Representative Abler.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry I missed the first part of your testimony. It's an interesting idea, and I understand some of your merits behind it. Trips on Dabney's point, I mean, some places just aren't good polling places. You know, I mean, you can't believe there's not a church down the road somewhere or someplace that's bigger. And I mean, just because some group decide, I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to, and maybe you need more polling places if you know there's a big turnout coming, and nobody should have to wait 2 or 3 hours in line. That's just ridiculous. You know, then that the local people should say, oh, gee, we need to split the precinct in half. Let's have, you know, whatever. And I know this is controversial. I looked at your authors list, and it was one side of the aisle, and I know you believe in this, and you got a call for a roll call, not like the first two bills we've heard today. Is there some way to find some middle ground on this? If you tried to reach out to the people spend much more time on this than me. Representative Bernardi, you're kind of a bipartisan type. I remember from the past when you were here, we were working education issues. And how's that going, the outreach part?
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Representative Abler. What we've been finding is more people learn about it, they become more comfortable with it. And so I'm remaining hopeful. I know Representative Sanders, we need to follow up with him on. I mean, his city is really feels strongly, the person who runs the elections feels really strongly the importance of this. So I'm hoping as people become more educated that we'll get more support. So frankly, I'm optimistic.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler,
I appreciate optimism. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bernardi or Ms. Frazier, whichever one. Can you tell me, because this would be just an early ballot, is it going to be treated similar like the absentee ballot, that if there was a problem, say a felon voted erroneously, would we be able to get that ballot back or no?
Ms. Frazier. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in neither case is the ballot retrievable. I mean, an absentee ballot is put in an envelope and put aside. However, there are not verifications done between the time when the ballot is, when the voter turns in the ballot and when it is counted on election day.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Frazier, isn't it true, though, when you have your absentee ballot, they're still held in the original envelope that has the individual voter's signature on the envelope itself?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's true up until 5 p.m. the Friday before the election, at which point right. Election officials are allowed to go through the accepted absentee ballots and take them out of the envelopes and begin feeding them into the machines.
And so, Mr. Chair and Ms. Frazier, so is that how these early votes would be handled, that they would be in an envelope with the individual signature on the envelope to show that who that voter is, or no? Or is this, you said, I think you said that they would automatically go into the counting machine, isn't that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, they are put into the ballot box just like they are on election day.
So if a felon erroneously voted, realized it after the fact, and wanted to try and get back their ballot, they would not be able to get their ballot back. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is true. Representative Anderson, I have the answer to your previous question. And the requirements for election judges of different political parties is not found in this bill. It's found in the base election law. So either in Chapter 204C as in CAT, which regulates activities on election day, and because this is considered a polling place, that would have some control, as well as the absentee ballot chapter, which is 204B as in boy, which also requires that ballots be processed by election judges of different major political parties.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Frazier, would that apply since it's in the statute that's for election day provisions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this is considered a polling place, and so all of the requirements of polling places would apply. So, for example, there can't be signs. Representative Abler would need to remove his signs from 100 feet from the building, as well as the need for election judges of different major political parties.
Okay, Representative Simon.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I know we don't yet have total agreement on this bill, to say the least, but let me just bring up a couple points. First, I know that one particular area of disagreement is the idea of poll challengers. And one criticism I've heard is that with a rolling 15-day period, it's going to be difficult to get poll challengers to all the polling places. But I think something that's left out some of the time is that there are fewer polling places. So where I live, you'd have St. Louis Park City Hall, for example, or Hopkins City Hall, which would do the early voting part. It wouldn't be one in every precinct necessarily, so there would actually be fewer places to cover. The other thing I think that's important to realize, as Representative Bernardi has said, is there are 32 states that do this. And they have pretty divergent ideological kind of bents. And for those who have partisan suspicions about this, I really doubt that the legislatures and governors of Arkansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, states like that, who have had early voting and persisted in having early voting, I don't think they're in on the plan to hijack elections for one particular party, their own or anyone else's. So I just think we have to step back here. I know there's always, and there should be, a lot of scrutiny and questions asked about something that's new. On the other hand, nor should we just jump into something because other states do it, but 32 other states, including states that, as I say, have a wide kind of divergence in political culture, you might say, or diversity of political cultures, do this, and I think their voters like it because it's convenient and it's a better way to get more votes earlier. And by the way, the political campaigns love it too, because although no one knows who voted for whom, you can cross voters off of your list, and during those final 14, 15 days, you don't have to send the mailings, and you don't have to do the other field work that you normally have to do. So in Iowa, for example, I know that they love it for that reason. That's often a battleground state in presidential elections. They have early voting. By the way, all the states that surround us, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, all have early voting for 2 weeks or more, and the political campaigns and others love it because you know that Joe Blow or Jane Doe voted 7 days before, 8 days before, 12 days before, and you don't have to waste money trying to get him or her to the polls or send them a mailing. So it helps with the sort of political class as well.
Okay, clerk will take the roll.
Carlson?
Aye.
Abler?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Ansel excused. Atkins? Beard?
No.
Reinhart?
Yes.
Clark?
Yes.
Davids?
No.
Dabney?
Yes.
Dean?
No.
Bittmer?
No.
Gunther?
No.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hausman?
Yes.
Hillstrom? Holberg?
No.
Hornstein?
Yes.
Huntley? Kahn?
Yes.
Manchesky?
Yes.
Moon?
No.
Mahoney? Mariani?
Yes.
Marquardt?
Yes.
McNamara?
No.
Mullery? Norris?
No.
Paymar?
Yes.
Plowski?
Yes.
Poppy?
Yes.
Simon?
Yes.
Wagenius?
Yes.
Woodard?
Being 15 ayes and 12 nays, the bill is passed and be placed on the general orders. We now have Representative Sanders' bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 591. Recommend to pass, refer to the general register unless it needs to go somewhere else.
No, that's the motion I think we need.
Okay.
Okay, so the motion is before us. Representative Sanders, on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. House File 591 seeks to provide some answers and some solutions to what do you do if there is a vacancy and nomination for partisan office. Clearly, this has happened a few times in our recent history. Missouri in 2000, I think it was, with Carnahan Ashcroft. 2002, in our state, Senator Wellstone died in a plane accident. And then again, we had a situation this past election cycle with the former lawmaker from Duluth when the state Supreme Court decision came back and the generalist of layman's terms, they basically said you candidate could withdraw at any time for any reason, which is obviously a big problem. So we started out working with the Secretary of State's office and a bipartisan group. Yes, technically in the interim, before the session started and came up with this solution that we think works and mathematically works to provide the best solution. There's no perfect answer here because there's so many different moving parts. But we believe that this is the best solution. Another reason that this bill is in front of you is the fiscal issues. There is no direct fiscal cost unless there is a statewide recount, in which case a new statewide election, which would cost about $3 million approximately, but that is only dispersed if there would be a new statewide election.
Okay, any discussion? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sanders, I believe they put an amendment or language in Representative Murphy's bill to provide the funding mechanism should this happen. Is the language of your bill also in Representative Simon's election bill?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holbert, yes, it is.
All right, thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Holbert moves that House File 591 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Or renews her motion. By the way, the reason that this is here is the potential cost. So that was why it was re-referred from the House floor back to Ways and Means. And Mr. Marks, if you could comment on that, I think we want to clarify why it was referred back.
Mr. Chair, members, it's relative to the comment I made before that the fiscal note states that there's the potential for up to a $3 million cost if there would have to be a new statewide election, that, as Representative Sanders referred to.
And that would be pretty rare, but we did have to cover it. And we talked about that, Representative Sanders. I don't know if you were here when touched on that or not. Okay. No further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carried.
Chair, members.
You're very welcome. We meet tomorrow, Tuesday, April the 16th, 10 a.m. And the two bills that we're going to have up are capital investment and the omnibus transportation policy bill. Anything else that we need to announce?
Well, I'm just thinking about this extra target fund we have, the $52 million, which has some floating value in it as we spend it. Under the House rules, we can't take money out of that to buy stuff within each of the other areas, can we, if we were in a mood?
Not with the omnibus bills, no.
Okay. Just keep thinking. It's trying to help out, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and that's no longer 52. It's 49 because we amended the House budget resolution the other day dealing with capital investment, And the lion's share of that will go when we have the omnibus pension bills coming through.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And that was a separate target. But understand that I think I know where you're coming at it from, but that's not in the cards right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with no further discussion, let's adjourn the meeting.